You're listening to Soundside. I'm Libby Denkman. The KUOW podcast 10,000 Things is back. Formerly called The Blue Suit, the show's host, writer, and creator, Shinyi Pai, tells intimate stories of Asian Americans. And the entry points for these stories are objects, like a resume, fishing tackle, or a time capsule found in a family home. Shinyi Pai recently stopped by to chat about 10,000 Things and to share the latest episode of her show.
I think from the beginning, the show that I wanted to make was always about different expressions of how people connect to and honor and think about their Asian American identities. And I really wanted to send the message that there is no one right way to be Asian. For myself, growing up in the 1970s and 80s, that was a period of time where there was really one pervasive image of what Asian Americanness was, which was this sort of model minority myth or identity. And it's very important to me in the stories that I choose and curate and tell that there are a lot of diverse representations of what Asian American identity are, that there are a lot of distinctive and original voices, some of which may have accents and may not be kinds of voices that we hear on the radio a lot. And I'm also really interested in mixed race and intersectional identities as a way to just think about how complex identity actually is.
There's an upcoming episode of 10,000 Things in which you're going to tell the story of a fisherman named Dylan Tomine. And you're looking into the concept of obsession with Dylan. What is Dylan's obsession?
Dylan's obsession is specifically fly fishing of steelhead trout.
This is very relatable to me because my dad went through a period of time when I was a kid where he was obsessed and created a fly fishing studio in our garage. And anyway, obsession is such a rich emotional terrain. Tell us a little bit about how it plays out in Dylan's life.
He has a strong relationship and connection to fishing from a very young age. It's something that he shares as a pastime with his father, and his grandfather also has a strong interest in fishing as well. And so as I think an experience that really came about for him through his family and his memories of family, this was a hobby that he really went deep with as an adult. And so when he tells these stories about how he would rearrange his freelance work life in such a way so that he could take long fishing trips. And it often meant that he had to miss family gatherings, or he might make a girlfriend unhappy. And it impacted his life in really big, profound ways. And later, that all changed when there were restrictions that were put on fly fishing on the Skykomish River, which is Dylan's home river. And those restrictions were put in place because of overfishing of steelhead trout. So he grew from being an avid fly fisherman to being a conservationist and a spokesperson for Patagonia. Hmm.
That's on an upcoming episode of 10,000 Things. I venture to say that obsession is also something that you can relate to, Shinyi. I know you speak about it in this upcoming episode. What did you relate to in Dylan's story?
Yeah, there were a couple things. So certainly I have chased my own obsessions or my deep passions. I think there's a fine line between obsession and addiction, but I talk a lot about my passion, which has always been writing, and how, like, as a younger person before I had a family, I would literally say to my partner, I'm going to go write in the woods of New Hampshire for 3 months now, and I'm just going to work on my poems. I'll see you later. And that was something that was okay when I was a younger person. But, you know, I think kind of speaks to what I prioritized or do prioritize in my life, what's important to me. I think also in Dylan's story, what I found very striking was that, you know, all passions and the things that we want to engage with deeply offer us something, some kind of knowledge about ourselves. And the way that Dylan talked about his relation to fly fishing and nature, there was really this sense of a rich and spiritual experience of his being in relationship to self and presence. And I think in some ways that practice for him became very contemplative or meditative in the way that it put him in touch with the self and the sacred. And that is very similar to how I think about my creative and writing practice.
Hmm. I mean, I could go on about this. I'm really fascinated by you touching on the sacred, because people who have in the past, in another era, maybe pursued, say, religious practices, that involves a lot of sacrifice. And it seems to me that an obsession like writing or an obsession like trout fishing, that involves sacrifice as well. And is there something about the sacrifice that puts you more deeply into the art or the pursuit that you're following? I don't know if you're if you have any reflections on that.
I think certainly you have to give up some things in order to have that deep experience with self. There is a selfishness about it, but I think that selfishness is also in some cases about getting to the point of like selflessness and merging with the thing. Mm. Yeah.
Your most recent episode of 10,000 Things is called A Time Capsule Returns. What is the story behind the time capsule?
The story of Time Capsule is about a mother and daughter, Donna Miskulta and her daughter, Anna Miskulta Cameron. And it is about this mother and daughter who grew up in a house that has a lot of things that are wrong with it and isn't a very comfortable place to live. And as a result, it can exacerbate the relationship between family members because of the sense of discomfort. When the daughter, Anna, is 9 years old, she hides a secret time capsule that she makes beneath one of the stairs in the house. And decades later, her mother decides to sell the house. And Anna remembers that she left this time capsule that was a kind of, yeah, encapsulation of her life and what she cared about when she was 9 years old. So she tells her mother. Her mother goes and finds the time capsule, which is exactly where her daughter left it. And the time capsule becomes this kind of window into the past, both of, you know, the beautiful and kind of, I don't know, pure perspective of a young child, and also the mother's window into the time that she was a mother in her life when things were rather difficult and there were mistakes made, there was regret.
You're a parent, and here we're talking about physical representations of childhood and what a child cares about, but also what a parent can experience through the physical representations of childhood. And at the beginning of the episode, you described the impact your son has on the space that you call home, his artwork on the wall, ascending pencil marks, tracing his height. How did this story of the mother and her daughter in A Time Capsule Returns change how you think about parenting?
Well, you know, Donna and Anna are on the other side of it. Anna's, you know, a grown woman with her own child now. And I think in that way, it is a story that got to play out in a way. And I am kind of more living it right now, right? It was really beautiful that Anna talks so openly and eloquently about the loneliness of childhood, because I think there's a parallel for that in the loneliness of mothering and motherhood. And I think the promise of being able to, when we mature, to be able to talk openly about the pain of that learning and those moments, it gave me a little bit of hope about where my son may be in 10 or 15 years. And you know, I think Anna talked a lot about if she were to make a time capsule now, what she would want to put in it for her kid, Elio, her son, and, you know, the message that she wanted to send to him, that I would send to my own child, is one of belonging and of being enough. And I think that is both a message of mothering the children that we have and that we love, but also mothering ourselves.
Shinyi Pai is the host, creator, and writer of the 10,000 Things podcast from KUOW. Check it out wherever you get your podcasts. And we're going to hear A Time Capsule Returns in just a moment here, Shinyi. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
And here is that episode of 10,000 Things, Time Capsule.
It wasn't until the pandemic that I, like a whole lot of other people, actually started to hang out at home. I stopped going into an office downtown every day and spent more time relating to the space where I live. This was an anomaly for me, having grown up in a house with a leaky roof and water-stained ceilings, a place that I constantly wanted to escape. On the days that my husband takes our son to school, I sink into the silence of our house, get reacquainted with each room. Some walls are a snapshot in time of my child's evolving artwork. Then there's my kid's height chart in the dining room, faint penciled lines marking his growth over the past 2 years. My son will remember the memories we made here, putting up a Christmas tree in the same corner of the living room every year, where he learned to make rice and bake cookies in the kitchen, practice his cursive at the dining room table. And me? I'll remember other things. The sound of my kid's bedroom door slamming shut in anger behind him. That time that the hot water heater quietly broke and gallons of water seeped into the carpet on my birthday. My home is a vessel of living history and time, and a record of my relationship to my family, for better or worse. And because of that, my relationship with it is complicated. Donna Miskolta's relationship with her house was complicated too.
When we bought the house in 1984, it was supposed to be a fixer-upper. It was supposed to be a first house, and we would eventually move to a better place, a bigger place to raise our kids. That never happened.
When we're young, life can feel full of promise. We have hopes and dreams for better futures, for a house of our own, for a sense of refuge. And then there's the reality of fighting over the rising costs of bills, home maintenance, and how to deal with house pests. Donna's husband had to deal with whatever crawled inside the house through a hole in the roof.
We thought he trapped rats, but it turned out they were squirrels. He kept them because he didn't want to release them because they would just come right back. And so he bought this giant cage and kept it in the garage. And he looked up at how to feed squirrels. And so every morning he would chop all these fresh fruits and vegetables for them and feed the squirrels. And they would go crazy.
Donna's husband fed the squirrels for about a month until the rain stopped, and it was safe for him to get on the roof and patch the holes. Donna lived in that fixer-upper for more than 3 decades. In that house, she raised 2 girls, Natalie and Anna, who grew into their young adulthood under that tattered roof. But Donna finally reached her limit of living in discomfort, and then the furnace broke.
We had been living with space heaters, and I would live basically in 2 rooms, either the bedroom or the living room, and that's where we kept the heaters. We had just gotten so tired of living that way that it was just like, we need to get out of here. And so we decided to sell.
Selling the family house mostly brought relief, but it also unearthed something unexpected and hidden. Welcome to 10,000 Things, a podcast about modern artifacts of Asian American life. I'm your host, Shinyi Pai. Today, a time capsule. When Donna went to sell her family's old home in Seattle, she knew it wasn't going to a new family or even someone looking to flip it. It was going to a developer, to be torn down and replaced. The corners and niches and doorways of memories would be gone. This made her daughter, Anna, a bit nostalgic.
She just said, could you do a video tour of all the rooms so I can have a memory of the house? And so I did that for her.
After I had watched the video of that last walkthrough of the house, I think something clicked in my mind. And I remembered the stair. And I remembered very, very fuzzily that I put something there as a child. So I asked my mom and I just said, I think there's something there. Can you just check?
I went there and there it was. And it was like lifting out some buried treasure.
And sure enough, it was there and I had left it there.
It was a blue Dutch cookie tin, a time capsule containing memories from the life of a 9-year-old Anna. The secret space that Anna Miskolta Cameron found as a kid lived at the base of the house's staircase. The whole family passed over those stairs every day.
And so all of them were painted gray except for the bottom one. It was painted white. And every time you stepped on it, it made a noise as if it were hollow. And it opened and it felt like a magical key, like really, like I was just hoping it would open, and then it did open.
At the time, Anna was really into reading books about princesses that lived in distant lands and olden times.
I was very interested in history and all of the time that separated me from this other person. And there's kind of a, there's a little bit of a morbid interest too of like the death and the drama associated with being a princess.
But Anna lived in 1999 in a post-grunge era Seattle, though there were modern pop princesses too.
That was probably the year Britney Spears' first album came out. And I remember listening to that a lot and just being immersed in pop culture generally.
She remembers staring at Britney's photo on the album cover and drinking in our culture's idea of beauty. Anna tried to emulate the sports bra and nylon sweatpants look from the Baby One More Time video. But her sister's hand-me-down pants were too long and made ugly noises as she squeaked down the hall. Nine-year-old Anna felt pulled in many directions, caught up in the popular culture of the late 90s while feeling drawn to the simplicity of princesses and pastimes. When and where did she belong? So Anna made a time capsule, created her own treasure box of cherished items to preserve for the future.
I felt so many connections with people from the past that I had read about. And I kind of wanted to continue that chain and be a link in the chain and send my message to someone in the future too. And I guess I had in my mind that, you know, a kid that lived in that house, maybe from the next family or even generations into the future, would find it.
Reaching out to a kid across time was one way that Anna coped with a painful tween phase.
I went to an alternative school that was smaller than other elementary schools in the district, and there were very few students of color in the school.
It's an in-between age in which a profound sense of loneliness can set in. We may begin to question where we belong and whether or not there's a place for us. For mixed-race kids like Anna, who is Filipino, Mexican, and white, that loneliness has a whole other dimension to it.
There was a core of very cool kids. They were white, they were very thin, they were pretty, and they usually had money. And they formed this kind of core that you aspired to get into.
The time capsule was Anna's secret. It stayed hidden beneath the stair. Anna grew into a teenager with new questions, and daughter and mother clashed.
I don't know if my husband had been doing work on the roof, but there was a rope up there that was tied around the chimney. And she used that rope to shimmy down from the second floor of the house and leave at night.
Yeah. I think when I got into high school, things changed a lot. And we had very difficult family dynamics. I was very mad at this inability to keep the peace in our household. So I just felt like, well, it's not going to hurt anyone if I just shut up and go to my room. Later on, that lack of communication led to arguments.
Anna made it out of adolescence and through college. She was living outside of the country when Donna decided to sell the house. With home prices soaring, old houses were snapped off the market all over Seattle. Donna didn't know anything about her daughter's secret stair.
I was thinking, why didn't I not know about that stair? I was like walking up and down that stair so many times. But I always knew when I hit that last step coming down, there was a hollow sound. And it would like, you know, it would sort of rock.
The discovery of Anna's time capsule pulled Donna back to a time before struggling with her daughter. Before the silence and before the fights.
Peter Rabbit cookies.
Anna's time capsule, the blue Dutch cookie tin, used to hold her mom's sewing kit.
There's our cat, Jessie. There's our cat, Lily. Oh, this is a picture of Anna and her soccer team. And then Anna on a bridge.
There was a little silver box with little shapes brightly painted over it, purchased at one of those little Mexican craft stores. And
coins. And then also Canadian $5. And then she had this letter to the future.
A 9-year-old Anna had handwritten a letter to put inside her secret time capsule. It was sealed in an envelope that said,
"Do not open until the year 3010.
Donna was curious, but she wasn't sure if she should open it.
I kind of like the idea of having it unopened. It was sort of a sacred thing to me. And I think once it was opened, sort of that magic would disappear.
I read about Anna's letter to the future on Donna's blog. She wrote how a letter like this felt like it needed some sort of ritual. I was producing this arts event with a live audience, and so I invited Donna to open the letter on stage with me.
Here it is. It's sealed.
Anna gave her permission to do it, but only if her mom promised to stop reading if there was anything embarrassing.
So I don't know what's in the letter, and if she had written this when she was 13, no way would I be reading it in public. But here it is, the words of a 10-year-old. Hello from the 20th century. Okay, I guess it's a form, so she had found somewhere. So the best things in my life are my family, because I love them very much, and they're always there to support me when I need it. And also my cats, Nina, Lily, Jesse, and Piper. My personal goals for the future are to become a soccer player, a singer, or an actress. They're all very important things I like to do in my free time.
I was looking at myself, you know, projecting what I would be in the future. And, you know, I think wanting to be things like a pop star or an actress or a soccer player, that's really about the spotlight. And that's about being loved and being appreciated and being adored. They were kind of redeeming professions to a child that didn't fit in and that didn't feel loved or popular. And then there's also the part about looking outward at the world and wanting to do something selfless too.
My wishes for the future of the world are for people to stop polluting the planet and for people to stop killing, hating, and hurting.
I remember being very aware of environmental issues at a young age because of my mom's job, and she worked in recycling education. There was a contrast in that letter to the future. I want to make things better for me, and I also want to make things better for the world.
Signed, Anna Miskolta Cameron, 11/7/99. So, thank you for letting me share.
I remember that moment vividly on stage because I was there, and I remember, the emotion coming into your voice and you're getting choked up. Just it was so touching and tender.
I don't know. It felt kind of like this door opening into the past, into who this child was back then, and actually who I was back then, I think. It's hard to thinking about who you were as a mother back then, thinking about all the mistakes we made. And I'm just going to, you know, going to assume that all families at some point in their histories have some level of dysfunction, and ours was no different. And a lot of it had to do with living in a house that was not really functional.
Anna Hannah's letter and time capsule were a portal back to a time of childhood when the world still felt closely drawn and intimate. When home was a refuge from a world that didn't notice, let alone embrace, a young girl seeking to find her place. The time capsule cradled that moment and those memories.
I think we didn't really have good communication for a very long time, almost until, you know, around when Elio was born, when my son was born.
Now that she's raising her own child, there are things that we both see, and I think it's just these stages that are necessary to go through, these difficult times, and with time and maturation on everybody's parts, we come together in a place that's a lot stronger than before.
Recovering her daughter's time capsule allowed Donna to recognize the core parts of the open-hearted, caring young girl that Anna once was, and the parts of that identity that Anna had carried forward with her into adulthood. Anna sees it a little differently.
I look at that letter and, you know, there's a certain innocence to it, and it's sweet on the surface, but I think what I see is something a little sadder. Childhood and adolescence are periods of such deep insecurity. In mine, I felt very insecure all the time, and I felt lonely.
Even if Anna's time capsule hadn't survived the demolition of her childhood home, those moments would have lived on within who she is as a vessel of memories.
If he were to make a time capsule today, what would you put inside of it?
Well, I would put inside photos. I would put inside a letter to my son, even if he's not the one to read it. I would put inside all of these little mementos of his birth. I have a little clip of his umbilical cord that in the chaos of his birth, I just wrapped it up in plastic. And then I just left it like that. And I would let Elio decide, because I think that children should be the ones to to put together time capsules.
What do you hope for Elio when he's 10 years old?
I hope that he has a strong sense of self, and that he's kind. I just want him to know that he's enough.
A time capsule uncovers physical relics and memories that speak to a particular moment in a personal history. But what it can also contain is the key to a younger self, a person that we may be unprepared to come face to face with again. With that surprise encounter, we get to revisit who we may have once been in more complicated times, to look back at our journey, and to gaze forward at the time we have left and how far yet we have to voyage.
That was the most recent episode of 10,000 Things. The host, writer, and creator of the show is Xinyi Pai, with production by Whitney Henry Lester and editing by Jim Gates. Partial funding of 10,000 Things was made possible by the Seattle Office of Arts and Culture's Hope Corp grant, a recovery-funded program of the National Endowment of the Arts, plus support from the Windrose Fund. You can find this and all episodes of 10,000 Things wherever you get your podcasts or on our website, kuow.org. Thanks for listening to Soundside. This show is only possible because listeners support us. If you're able to give right now, please check out the show notes for a link to donate. And don't forget, you can listen live on KUOW 94.9 FM Seattle at noon and 8 p.m. Monday through Thursday, or anytime online at kuow.org.